This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Mel Torre, the president and CEO of Autonomous Solutions. It was not that long ago that the word autonomous was not part of our daily conversation. But that's all changed recently. News sources like the Washington Post, the New York Times, and NPR are regularly reporting that autonomous vehicles, also known as self-driving cars, are coming, and they're coming a lot sooner than most of us currently anticipate. Google has been test driving autonomous vehicles for several years, albeit with a human driver behind the wheel just in case. This past summer, Uber launched a driverless service in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, also complete with a backup human driver. On the other side of the world, and just days before Uber, a relatively small startup called Newtonomy began offering driverless taxis within Singapore's popular One North business district. I'm proud to share that Utah also has a leader in this space. Autonomous Solutions, Inc. is developing driverless farming and mining machinery like tractors and large earth-moving equipment such as bulldozers, excavators, and haul trucks. Mel Torre, CEO of Autonomous Solutions, thank you for joining us this morning.
Great to be here.
So, you know, people have heard of autonomous cars. I think it might be the first time people are hearing of autonomous tractors and autonomous mining equipment. Is that a relatively new space, or how long have you guys been working on this?
I don't know whether this is bragging or embarrassing, but we've been working on it for quite a while. I started 20 years in it. We spun out a company out of Utah State University 16 years ago. And that was to work on the tractor side. And then we moved into mining in about 2005. So it's been a while.
Are you a contrarian by nature, or what made you think, let's go to earth-moving equipment, let's go to farming equipment, as opposed to the BMW that you're driving to work every day?
Part of it would come from my farming background, just being around earth-moving equipment and driving a tractor in a circle 18 hours a day. That tends to drive some thoughts of a better way. But I also think the expertise then that we had, plus the demand, was really coming from the agricultural space, the mining space, the labor issues, the quality of work, the maintenance costs, that kind of thing.
There's not many self-driving engineers, robotics engineers, that also have spent time driving a tractor.
No.
Did you grow up here in Utah? Did you grow up in a farming community?
I grew up in the middle of nowhere in Alberta, Canada, on a farm in a town called Grassy Lake with 122 people, and basically made my way down here to get away from the cows. So.
To get away from the cows?
The cows and the cold, yes.
Well, you may have gotten away from some of the cold, but there yeah. There are still cows here.
I figured this far south, we would be a lot warmer, but not so.
Interesting. And then you were getting your master's in robotics at Utah State?
Master's in electrical engineering, and definitely focused on the robotics side.
And when you came up with this idea for self-driving autonomous tractors, there's professors at the university, there's business advisors. What did people tell you?
Well, it started when I was an undergrad and I saw a wheelchair driving by itself down a hallway, chased it down, asked who the professor was in charge and started begging him for a job. My grades weren't stellar, and so it took a lot of begging. But after about 3 months, they hired me on and eventually went from sorting bolts to managing some work and published a paper that John Deere saw. And they came to us and said, hey, we really want to explore this robotic tractor concept. Can you make something safe that would avoid a three-year-old girl? And so we came up with a remote control car with a silhouette of a little girl on it, and we'd come driving at the front of a tractor and then created the intelligence in the tractor to avoid the little girl.
And so the paper that John Deere saw that you wrote, was it about bringing robotics into the farming industry?
It was, and about the safety elements of how do you keep a vehicle in the farming space that's driverless from hurting somebody or something. And so I was talking through just the guidance and the sensors that would keep it safe.
Okay. And how far from reality are robotic tractors?
I think we're quite close. We're doing farm trials right now. We've been doing them for a couple of years. I think the legislation and the standards and procedures, those kinds of things that provide a framework for litigation and best practices, those are lagging. And so we're a part of some key committees that are developing the standards so that as an industry, we are following what would be decided upon as a safe and wise approach to productizing this kind of technology. And so that's coming along, and it's very important that that is coupled with launching so that you have that support and framework in place for the productization.
You know, the people issues, the legislation, the liability side of things, those are really big, largely unanswered questions still.
Yeah, they're huge. And it's what really stopped us in the early years. 2001, we had a product out testing in orchards and vineyards for spraying dangerous chemicals. It was the ideal application, keeping someone safe, keeping them from having two-headed children. And the challenge was the liability. People every year disable safety systems on a tractor, for example, take a PTO safety shaft shield off, get themselves hurt, and then to avoid the public problems, they will settle out of court. And so there's millions set aside for that kind of issue. How many robotic tractors are you going to sell this year? And those kind of questions just couldn't support the expected risk of a robotic tractor. And so that was 15, 14 years ago that we were ready to launch. The customers were begging for it. The trials were going well. But that liability issue has definitely been an issue and a concern as.
And has that issue been addressed? Is that legislation, is that liability? Have the courts figured that out where a tool like this can be used in dangerous situations?
I would say two answers to that. One is that they have done incremental autonomy. And so first they started with steering for straight lines for a farmer. And then they started doing the implement actions at the end of the rows. And now they're doing the turns at the end of the rows. And now they're doing tougher paths. And
but there's still a human behind the
rail. There's still
a
human in it. But there were huge liability concerns with just if we control the steering, because, hey, it darts to the right and the farmer gets hurt.
So you're a student in this space. I fly airplanes as a hobby. Autopilots have been around since I was born 50 years ago.
Yeah.
How did the aircraft industry solve this? In many ways, aren't they kind of the leader in this autonomous solution?
Definitely. I think they've had a history and a DNA of safety and the redundancy levels that they really know how to conquer risk better than anybody. And there's definitely cost to that. It takes a month to change a line of code at Boeing. So that industry has done exceedingly well at managing risk, but they've had the processes and procedures in place and the safety standards. But also, there's fewer things to go wrong, and there's still a human behind the steering wheel on the airplane as well. So there's fewer things to run into. There's there's radars that can see people coming from a long ways away. That's impossible in corn right now, for example. Yep. You can't see someone 10 feet away.
People would be shocked. I mean, here in Utah, the wintertime, we have really poor air quality. Mm. And sometimes the visibility at the airport is what they call 00.
Yeah.
You cannot see in front of you, and you cannot see 1 foot below you, right? Mm-hmm. It's called 00.
Yeah.
There are systems that can land an airplane, commercial, that the general public are passengers on, that can land an airplane in 00 conditions. And the bigger issue is once they're on the ground stopped, how do they taxi from the runway to where the gate is?
Oh, wow.
And those solutions came after the landing solutions.
Yeah.
So it's incredible what the complexity of these autopilots can do.
Yeah.
These airplanes are also enormously expensive. So spending a few million dollars on systems like that can be put in. Tractors, how much is for somebody that's in the farming business, what's an average tractor sell for?
Oh, it's everywhere from 50 grand to 200-300 grand.
So relative to an aircraft, much less expensive.
Yeah, but there are some serious technical challenges that they don't have on the airplanes, like the radio signals penetrating trees. You can't get GPS under a tree where a plane pretty well can always get GPS. You can't get a radio signal through an orchard or through a crop of corn.
Here's where I'm going with that. Okay. How much does it cost to put a robotic system? My understanding is you can retrofit an existing tractor.
Yeah.
What does that cost a farmer?
Right now, it would be, it's under $100,000, and it depends on the application if they need to see through a crop of corn or if it's wide open tillage with a couple of thousand acres. So I would say it would range from $25,000 to $100,000, just depending on the kinds of sensors. That's a big driver.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Mel Torrey, the president and CEO of Autonomous Solutions, Inc. Not as expensive as I would have thought. What's involved in making a tractor self-driving? And the reason I say it's not, I mean, $100,000 is a lot of money.
Yep.
But relative to the cost of the person that's driving it, and that's a skilled position, those folks are making, I would think, decent money. Mm-hmm. The payback's probably, what, 2 years, if that?
Yep. Yep, that's about right. The what's involved, so you have to pretty well actuate everything, meaning you have to automate the steering and the throttle and the brake and the shifting. The more difficult things are, you don't have that human listening for a bearing that's gone bad, for smelling, for something burning, that perception of seeing through a crop that you're trying to harvest. And so that's where the money comes in, is really those sensing systems. That's where the complexity is.
Interesting. And I would think the industry's going there anyways to give early warning when this $100,000, $200,000 piece of equipment is having a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're definitely instrumenting and making it smarter, just like your car. You're getting better early warning. You're getting good messages. And so the automotive industry is really helping us. They are spending money on technologies that we can leverage, especially the sensor space.
Interesting. Yeah, the whole tech space, and it's nice that you have a huge market like the automotive industry that's bringing down the cost of the price, the cost of the pieces, that the sensors that you need.
Yeah.
So you're doing farm equipment, you're doing mining equipment. We were talking just before the show, you're in a wide variety of businesses. You were mentioning floor scrubbing equipment, like for office buildings to keep the floors shiny and clean. I think people are going to be surprised at how soon a tool like that will be commercially available.
Yeah, it's exciting. So we're doing the autonomous mining, the autonomous farming, and then the floor scrubbing and security surveillance. We just launched with Sharp out of Japan. And then in the automotive space, we're automating their testing. And so you can go to Detroit and watch cars jumping off cliffs. You can watch them rolling over testing or just running thousands of miles on durability tracks.
Well, let's talk about each of those. So okay. Floor scrubbing.
Yeah.
Right now, there's somebody that gets paid to do that, typically late at night. My father ran a small grocery store. And a couple times a year, he and I would work, you know, from midnight till 6 in the morning, scraping, taking off the old sealant and putting on new sealant. And it was a tough job, and there were nasty chemicals, and it was never my favorite time of the year when he and I would do that, although it was a nice father-son bonding time. So these automated machines are going to be available here first of the year.
Yeah, starting next year, we will be launching pilots with some of our biggest partners, biggest customers.
And is this something that cleaning crews buy outright, or is this something that you charge by the hour for them to use?
Interesting question. I'm actually working on the different business models and exploring that in other
if
spaces.
If you can get it, the per hour model would be spectacular.
Yeah,
for
so we call that like the robotics as a service. And so we actually have a command center with fiber optics up to Logan, Utah, where we can take over the mine. We have an autonomous mine running down in South Africa with trucks. We can actually take over that mine remotely and drive the trucks, control the whole operation from across the world. So that theory of running 40 grocery stores from one command center and your human is handling the exceptions, that's definitely the model. But in the model I'm excited about. In South Africa, we've actually trained the truck drivers. A lot of the companies we work with pledge not to lay people off, and so we will retrain, re-educate, and give them jobs that are less dangerous, less monotonous, and leverage more of their intelligence. And so in South Africa, we have the truck drivers are now, instead of getting bounced around in the truck, they're in a command center, and we drive the trucks far faster than they could handle as humans because of the abuse of their bodies.
Interesting, which brings up another point that we're going to talk about later in the show, which is just the impact on the employment of the country and the world. I mean, these are big seismic changes that are taking place. So you can control a mining truck in South Africa from Logan, Utah.
A fleet of trucks, yes.
That's amazing. What's the latency for that?
It's pretty big. The ideal for controlling a truck, like with a remote control, steering wheel, joystick, like a video game, you need about 100 milliseconds latency to do that. But all of our vehicles are autonomous. And so really what the human is addressing is an exception that happens. Hey, it gets a flat tire. It gets confused by a weed that rolled in front of it or something like that. And so latency really isn't an important issue because you're not playing a safety role or a critical control role. And so you start the operation, you're reviewing in real time, the sensors on the vehicles keep them safe, and you're just handling those, I got stuck, I'm confused kind of problems.
You know, I think one of the first robotics that most of us got introduced to and was on the played in the media, and again is related to aviation, is drones, military drones. I believe there's a big command center in North Dakota that can fly drones all over the world. However, when it comes to land these things, they like to have people usually within eyesight of where the drones are going to land for that latency issue. Yeah. You know, and there they got to make corrections fairly quickly, which is why I asked that question. You know, it's interesting how aviation has been a leader in this. I hadn't thought of that before this this interview. Are the thought leaders in the robotics space, are a lot of those folks from the aviation industry?
I think there's some, but I don't see an overwhelming majority of them.
Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more with Mel Torre, the president and CEO of Autonomous Solutions. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Mel Torre, the president and CEO of Autonomous Solutions. So before break, we were talking about some of these other lines that you have. You've got tractors, you've got earth-moving equipment. You've got the floor scrubbing equipment that's going to be doing pilot test here at the first of the year, which is really soon. You also have security robots. What are the security robots going to do?
Surveillance is really the number one application.
So not kind of an Arnold Schwarzenegger model?
Not quite. But I guess one of the more dangerous is the approaching people who shouldn't be on a corporate campus, for example. The amount that they're paying those people is not enough for them to tolerate the risks. And so they'd rather be at a command center where these robots are out intervening, talking to through an intercom system, hey, you're not supposed to be here, what's going on, addressing those alarm triggers and going out and checking out those kinds of breaches to the security.
So what does a robot like that look like?
Well, we could show you a picture.
Except we're on radio.
Yeah, we're on radio. I would say it's similar to the size of a child's four-wheeler, about that size. It's got a mast that can raise up with a camera to look over fences, look through windows, that kind of thing. But four-wheel, jogging speed kind of velocities with a bunch of sensors on it so it can detect fire and chemical leaks and bio leaks of those kinds of risks or threats.
I was just reading about a Bay Area company that's providing a similar service.
Yeah.
And they're doing the per-hour model. It's $7 an hour, which is a bargain because full in the security guard's got to be quite a bit more expensive than that. And I agree with you, you know, for the level of risk that they take, that's a job that doesn't pay what I think it should pay given the risk. We've all been in movies where the security guard, the flashlight is going into a room and you're yelling, don't go in there. Yeah. Particularly, you know, that's probably a $10 to $15 an hour job.
Definitely.
Full in benefits and that's probably closer to $25 an hour. In your case, are you thinking of selling the robots outright or same model?
Similar model, but it's a three-year lease. We're partnered with Sharp out of Japan, and they have been very successful in leasing their office equipment in a three-year model. And And so that's the general idea. We definitely sell it based on a per hour type of comparison. We are looking at launching a separate company to do it as a service. And so we're actually talking to investors about launching a sister company that will go out and do it by the hour. And so we've negotiated pricing and have found executives in the security business that are excited about it and can really see the financial, the win there.
Oh, it's a huge ROI. Yeah. Again, probably pays for itself in 2 years. Anything over that is profit. Yeah. You just mentioned investors. What you're doing is expensive. It takes a very talented team to do it. Plus, the hardware that you're using and the earth-moving equipment, you know, getting a model of that and working with it, that's all very expensive stuff. I looked on Crunchbase, which is a source where you can find out how companies have been financed. Doesn't look like you've had any outside equity investors. Are you bootstrapping this?
We've bootstrapped. We've raised about over $85 million, but it's been all through doing the dance and convincing these large equipment manufacturers or large end users like the mining companies that, hey, we can bring you value that you cannot find elsewhere. And so it's been quite a journey.
You know, as somebody that does some angel investing, I love the fact that you're partnering with potential customers and they're putting up the money day one because nobody knows the value and the potential impact on the industry like those partners do. And it's a great sign. I mean, $85 million is a lot of money. So it's non-dilutive to you and your team. Yeah. You've been at this almost 20 years now. In hindsight, do you wish you had taken some money along the way from outside investors, maybe to get to grow quicker, to get into a space sooner?
That's a great question. It seems like there is finally a convergence of the technology and the need that it really is ready to explode now. There are definitely days when I think it would have been easier. There were some windows of opportunity that we may have missed, but the downsides of I need an exit. I love what I do. I love robotics. I want to die shuffling into work, and so I can't imagine something more fun than robotics. And so I've never been interested in that exit model. And that's just what's celebrated in industry. That's what we have been barraged by over the last 2 years. 18 months to 2 years, we've had weekly investment inquiries from private equity and venture trying to get into the robotics space. But 98%, 95% of those have been, yeah, you will sell within 3 to 7 years. That is going to be the fine print because we want the maximum value, the maximum valuation of the voting shares. And so I'm not interested in exiting. And so I've just never been willing to take that
quandary there.
Yeah.
You've got a quandary. And, you know, I think all the investors I know are very upfront about it, right? Yeah. And, you know, I've got X dollars in this hand, and I'm going to give it to you to grow your business. But at some point, and 10 years is pretty long-term time frame for institutional investors. Right. At some point, I need you to return money into the other hand, which means an exit.
Yeah.
And there's some companies that's not a match for.
Right.
And you may very well be in the case. In that situation, you've done it 20 years on your own. You've gotten $80 million of funding and goods and services because you're in a space that's providing tremendous value, potential value for your partners. One of those partners is Ford. How long have you been working with Ford?
Oh, probably 5 or 6 years.
And you mentioned earlier about the cars tipping over, the durability testing. Is this mostly the crash testing that we see videos of on TV?
Ford, the majority of theirs is the durability testing. So those rough rumble strips where people are getting injured on a regular basis with back injuries and just shaking their body as they need to accelerate this testing of a new model of a Mustang or a pickup truck or a 2-ton truck. And so we put automated kits into all of those, and then their technicians can move it to the new model as it becomes available. And then they have a command center, just like we're talking, where they have one guy sitting there with the software managing and overseeing a lot of robotic cars.
Interesting. And so how did Ford do this before you guys got involved?
It was humans, and they would just get shifted out of the vehicles on some up to a 30-minute interval. So their bodies just can't take it anymore. 30 minutes, they swap out, throw another guy in. 30 minutes, swap out. And there's been injuries, not at Ford, but as frequent as two in a weekend. They have to go to the hospital because of the accelerated tests that they're trying
to do. It's a horrible job. Yeah. It's a very tough job.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a perfect application. Low-hanging fruit. They don't want people around anyway to see their secret new cars, so they keep the site protected. So it really was a perfect fit, and we get thousands of miles a month on our vehicles, electronics.
That's probably a private track.
Yep.
Right? These are full-size cars, production-ready cars. They're just doing testing before they go out to the public, make sure they're durable enough. What's your thoughts on... And we touched on it a little bit earlier, but what about self-driving cars? I mean, how you're on I-15? You drove down from Logan today. Thanks for doing that journey. Yes. That was almost 2 hours. We appreciate you coming in. What would you have thought if going down I-15 at, I'm assuming you were doing the speed limit at 65 miles an hour? You looked over and the car next to you had nobody in the front and there's two people sitting in the back. Would that make you nervous or would you be comfortable?
Oh, great question. It wasn't raining. No one's asked it that way before. I think I would be nervous. I don't think we're ready. I think there are so many exceptions, scenarios that we just haven't got all of them covered. And so we've seen some accidents. I'm thrilled that...
Not many, actually. Surprisingly
not many,
few.
But there are just so many exceptions that they can't handle. One, weather-wise, there are no sensors that can handle the weather right now, the bad weather. And then there are just enough exceptions. So they're getting millions of miles on these systems, but they're still that. There are still some they aren't going to catch for a long time. And so it's exciting. It's definitely lowering my costs. It's bringing the public awareness of, well, if they can drive a Google car, surely they can get my tractor to drive autonomous. And so it's really been a huge mind shift in the industry of all of these others, no matter what we're in. Well, if they can do the car in an urban environment, surely they can do my floor scrubbers. Surely they can do my security robots. Surely they can. So it's just been wonderful. In addition to the lowering of costs of the sensing and the computers and that kind of thing.
So you just mentioned something. You know, these cars have millions of miles on them, and they do.
Yeah.
I mentioned in the green room, I took a class, an online class at Stanford on machine learning, and the supply of data is critically important to getting these algorithms down right. And just on a very high level, take people behind the scenes on these self-driving cars. There are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of algorithms that are running with the data that the sensors are seeing, and they're competing for which algorithm has the highest level of confidence. And that algorithm is the one that takes over for all these unexpected situations. To get those algorithms right, it's not necessarily the best algorithm. It's the best data and the most data because you can train these things. So Google has millions of miles. There's a rumor Apple is doing this. Uber is in the space. Does this change? My fear is it's not a fair competitive environment down the road. There will be new monopolies created by those that have the data. Are you at all worried about that?
Not worried at all, but you're definitely right. And most people think that Google has the advantage. They have 2 million miles right now. But Tesla, they're getting 1 million miles a day. And so they've instrumented all of the cars that sell with all of the sensors and with extra computational power so that they can actually run algorithms in the background and compare with what the human did with what their algorithm said he should have done. And they're voting those algorithms and they are building up that competency. And Elon Musk said, yeah, 99.9% is pretty easy. It's the 0.19999 that with AI is going to be incredibly difficult. The amount of miles you're going to have to accrue to get the safe operation. And so they're getting 1 million a day. Uber is getting 10 million a day. And so you just see an exponential change in who's got the data is going to be able to develop the best algorithms. And so now Uber has to get that instrumentation in place, and they are, to be collecting that kind of information. So everyone thought Google was the monopoly on this technology. You just look at what Tesla's doing, an order of magnitude, like daily versus 2 million in how many in the last 10 years with Google, and now Uber with 10 million miles a day. It's just, it's exciting. It is going to bring that data so that we can train these algorithms and make sure that they're safe. I don't have a concern, maybe because I'm not competing with them.
Here's, well, you're not, but here's my concern. I want to circle back to your business in a second, but imagine the tens of thousands, likely millions of United States jobs that are with the traditional automakers. And how do they compete if they don't have access to the millions of miles that Uber and Tesla are collecting on a daily basis? I mean, there are seismic shifts that are going to take place because of the data. And let me explain to the audience one of the reasons I'm worried. If I can buy a car that's likely to get in an accident once in 250,000 miles, and the other car has a probability of getting in an accident once in a million miles, which car am I going to buy? I'm going to buy the one in a million miles, right? Yeah. I mean, it's my family that's in that car. It's going to be a huge competitive advantage. How these vehicles are insured. You know, right now I have my own driving insurance, but I hope I've got a 16-year-old driver that is driving as well. She's a good driver. A computer is a better driver than I am, and it's darn for sure a better driver than a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
Insurance is going to completely change. I mean, they're going to have a cost advantage because the cost to insure a car where the algorithm gets in an accident once every million miles is going to be much less. How do we avoid what happened to the country at the turn of the 19th century when there were oil monopolies, there were all these monopolies that had taken place?
I don't think you'll see much difference compared to what we have today. You are seeing that all of them are making major plays. GM bought Cruise for $1 billion, a company a third the size of mine.
I'm sure your phone started ringing from that. That's when the venture capital calls started coming in.
So that they're making a play. Volvo's partnered with Uber. GM is playing with – so they're all making major plays. To get to the companies that have the ride-sharing kind of mileage. They're instrumenting their equipment. They're trying to get the over-the-air monitoring and over-the-air updates like the Tesla. So we're seeing that they're all spending the money to be in strategic positions to maintain their market share in some form. So I have not seen that any of the innovators out there are lone wolves anymore, that pretty well they're all associated with major automakers.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Mel Torre, the president and CEO of Autonomous Solutions. So we're talking about these algorithms and how they vote, and the one that has the highest confidence takes over, and millions of miles helps train these algorithms. And there's these very tiny incremental steps where the algorithm gets a little bit better as it has access to more and more data. How do your algorithms learn? Because I would imagine it's very difficult in agricultural and in mining to get millions of miles.
Yeah, so the decisions are less navigation around and amongst traffic, but more perceiving the environment and making sure that if there is an obstruction, that they are detecting it. And so whether that's because of weather, whether that's because I'm trying to see through corn or alfalfa or canola. And so it's a different problem. Automotive has it as well, but it's more the sensor fusion, the understanding of what the sensor is telling you and making sure that you're perceiving the environment correctly versus a bunch of high-speed navigation of humans making decisions, predicting those kinds of behaviors and reacting correctly. So I would say it's less of an issue in a grocery store. Like the security company you mentioned had a 2-year-old, 18-month-old chase it in a factory, in a mall to give it a hug. that's more of some of the challenges we face is the human interaction with our floor scrubber. If it's running in the local Macy's and a little kid comes and tries to get on it or give it a hug, do we react correctly? That's more of the things we're dealing with than 70 mile an hour and a car darts in front of us, those kinds of things.
So I think people were chuckling at the beginning, thinking of these floor scrubbers and, oh, that sounds like an easy thing to automate. You bring up some really, really important subjects, though, right? I mean, it's still going to be interacting with humans. How do you make sure it's safe for the public for those rare encounters with humans?
What we've done is bring in the expertise from the automotive industry, where they have been focusing on functional safety and the approaches to design that looks at all the failure modes and then designs the redundancy in place to minimize the impact. And so they have analyses that puts numerical figures to the likelihood of something happening and the redundancies around making sure that it doesn't happen. And so we've brought in people from Ford and GM who have that expertise, who help us in that design process to make sure that we're taking the most intelligent and safe approach to looking at risk A. Child comes up to give me a hug. How does this robot respond? What are the levels of sensing and bumpers and things like that to make sure that it responds
correctly?
So not
only do you benefit from the sensors that the auto industry is developing, and you also benefit from the human capital that's being developed. Right now, people may be surprised. The next hub of the auto industry is really taking place in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ford has a very large and expanding office complex there. I mentioned the class that the Stanford class that I took online, that was taught by a professor, Andrew Ng. His full-time job is he's the chief technology officer of Baidu, which is the Google of China. Now, why is the chief technology officer of Baidu in China teaching a class at Stanford? Because he wants access to the best and the brightest. How do you, in Logan, Utah, compete for some of the best and brightest?
I think the positive is that there are a few areas where you can do robotics in these other industries. Other than automotive, and if you want automotive, you pretty well have to be in Silicon Valley. So there are enough out there that want to be in robotics and want to be in some of these other leading-edge industries that want to come and participate. And I think the other is the criticality of getting alumni from the universities. Those have been really our two key niche. People who just love robotics and are emphatic about it and must do robotic farming. There's only a couple of options for that. Or, hey, I want to get back to Utah and I'm working at CAT or I'm working at John Deere. And so we've literally interviewed people from there in the last week. So that's our core hiring pool.
And let's remind people of the technical talent at the Utah State University. I mean, they have a very large and very well-respected space program.
Yeah, we've got incredible departments up there. I serve on advisory committee for the college and for the electrical engineering department. And their hands-on approach to education, where when I was an undergrad, I was putting projects on the space shuttle. And so that ability to do real-world problem-solving compared to getting an answer at the end of the book, in the back of the book, is just phenomenal. Outstanding. The things that I learned there, I would not be here. I would not have started this company. It would not be where it's at unless I got that undergraduate opportunity to put two projects on the space shuttle.
That's amazing. So as an undergrad, you were actually responsible for a part of the payload of a couple space shuttle programs.
Yeah. So on the first one, I did the engineering. And the second, I had managed a third of one of the payloads.
Is that common up at Utah State?
Yeah.
Obviously, the space shuttle program's not running now. So those
Correct. So that program isn't as much, but they still have research programs on the space side where undergraduates can participate. Where things have moved is into these competitions, which are very similar lessons to be learned there. Very hands-on senior programs, hands-on with these different competitions, where whether it's robotics or a solar-powered car that can go this far, those kinds of things. USU has just made that a priority, and I will hire someone with that experience over two GPA points higher that just got the answers in the back of the book.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest today is Mel Torre, the president and CEO of Autonomous Solutions. So we've got about 5 or 10 minutes left in the show. And I want to switch to some of these bigger questions, philosophical questions. We were talking in the green room ahead of time, and we were chuckling, you know, big thoughts, philosophical thoughts. But let's start with a few of these that are really important. What about the impact on jobs in the United States? I mean, right now, unemployment nationwide is running at about 6%. Here in Utah, I think we're second or third lowest in the nation at 3.5%. Are you at all worried about the next generation and whether there will be enough jobs for everybody?
No, I think our mission statement is to help people reach their potential. And that idea of getting people out of these mind-numbing, dangerous, dull jobs is really what motivates us. Get people doing what they're good at, their thinking and creativity. And we are just seeing the demand from these industries coming to us as they can't find people. In the vineyard space, someone told us they've never been able to get a black guy or a white guy to last more than 2 weeks. And it's only the people, the Latinos, people from Mexico, that can handle the level of effort it takes to maintain an orchard or a vineyard. They can't get those people over the border right now, and they are in trouble. And the minimum wage going up is putting companies out of business. So you're putting iPads at tables and restaurants. There's just an inability to stay feasible, financially viable with the pressures with both the minimum wage and the lack of labor.
Yeah, no, I heard dairy farmers in Wisconsin being very concerned with the solutions to this immigration challenge, because for them, they have to have access to folks from other countries. And so making sure that there is access, they're concerned with, obviously, right now, immigration is a big subject. So I've heard that as well. So, you know, some of those are more manual type jobs, lower paying type jobs. I work in the money management industry. And there's a lot of service type jobs. There's a lot of, frankly, right now, jobs that pay well, that require a high level of intelligence to do, that it is shocking how well artificial intelligence is catching up to speed with what used to be an area of expertise for some folks. I see it more broad stroked. Mm-hmm. Are you concerned there? And I mentioned earlier, I've got a 16-year-old daughter, and I spend time thinking, you know, she asked me for advice. Mm-hmm. We're going to see college, UEA weekend is coming up soon as we record this, on college majors. And I spend a fair amount of time researching that to see how susceptible is this going to be to AI.
Mm-hmm. Great question. I'm an optimist, I believe that, and naive often, but optimist that just as these same concerns have been raised over the years, going from horses to tractors, that same kind of warning bell, and it's never happened the way the pessimist projected that it would. I think critical that you're not investing in horseshoes. We have to be intelligent in what where it's going to go, but I don't doubt that we're going to be just fine, and that there will be new jobs that will leverage our creativity and our intelligence. We are a long ways off, as you mentioned, the AI and driving a car. It's going to take a long time for us to get that confidence where I'm going to be comfortable seeing cars in the driving next to me without people in them. So I think we're not as far as some people think we are. The press has been very positive about the potential, and they are trying to raise money, and these companies are telling good stories. But I think as a people, we're going to be fine, just like we have been in past iterations.
I agree with you. I'm an optimist. This is a big, big seismic shift. I mean, just think about self-driving cars, and then there's self-driving trucks, and they tend to blend well with the electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. People will be able to spend more for vehicles, bigger batteries, longer range, stuff like that. And the ripple effect, just think about like the truck stops that we all stop when you go on a trip across the country. Some of those truck stops, the economy in those teeny tiny towns is driven by people stopping to get gas and picking up milk and snacks. Mm-hmm. That's all going to change.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's going to change, I think, for the better.
All right. Well, we will stay optimistic. Staying on this just for a little bit longer, I read last Black Friday, and it's coming up again, right, just after Thanksgiving, that Amazon did one-third of all e-commerce in the United States was done on the Amazon platform. Now, they serve as a platform for other third-party sellers. Yeah. That is a staggering number.
Yes.
And one of the things I point to for how are they able to do that, I would argue it has a lot to do with machine learning and artificial intelligence. They know the type of products that we're likely to be tempted to buy. So when we're on there, they can suggest certain things that are going to be effective, and they also know how to do dynamic pricing probably better than anybody.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm definitely helping in that problem. I definitely use them a lot. I think, as
are we all.
Yeah. Right? I don't think that I've been coerced into buying a lot of stuff on there that I didn't want or wasn't going there to buy, but I go there to buy everything. So I think their artificial intelligence on the pricing side has definitely been effective. I think, again, I study leadership a lot, and the dynamics of their leader and the vision and where he's taking them, as well as Uber and others, they have driven that way because of a vision, and others aren't. And sadly,
I'm a huge student of leadership and strong executives as well. Bezos is one of the best.
Yep.
I would push back and say you're giving Bezos too much credit. Now, he's directionally put the company there.
Yep.
The reason they're so effective is your space. The artificial intelligence, the machine learning. There, I talked about linear algebra. You have these purchase vectors,
yeah,
and they can match you up with a purchase vector of somebody else. I mean, there are some very high-tech tools that are really putting them head and shoulders above everybody else. Mm. Great for Bezos.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure it's good for society. I'm worried about these new monopolies,
yeah,
and I'm not a legislator,
mm-hmm,
but I think our legislature, not just here in Utah, but in the country, needs to start thinking about the power of information and how to disseminate that. Just like we didn't let one phone company provide phone service for the whole country, we had to break that up.
Yeah.
We didn't let one oil company provide gasoline to the whole nation, we had to break that up.
Yeah.
The new potential monopoly in my mind is information.
Yeah. That's
a big issue.
Yeah.
So just to close, and I'm sorry I kind of got off on a little detail there. You know, Bezos, brilliant guy. I think perhaps his best insight was he knew he was too early. The Amazon of today could not have existed in 1999.
Yep.
So he picked a niche and started off in books, highly profitable, huge value. And no physical bookstore could hold every book,
mm-hmm,
but Amazon could. So that was a foundation that allowed him to build a platform. You started this 20 years ago, farm equipment, mining equipment, bringing in robots. From the outside, I think somebody could say you were probably early, mm-hmm, maybe too early.
Yep.
What would you think? What would you reply? What's your response to that? Were you too early?
Yeah, I would say so. I think it's been foundational now as it's taking off of, wow, they're the pioneers. They did John Deere Robotics back in 98. That reputation and that history compared to a startup has definitely been critical to traction in winning certain customers. These monster billion-dollar companies, where are they going to bet? Where are they going to bet? Which companies are they going to work with? That's been key. So it was painful and slow, and I was in the early days thinking destination versus the journey, and when are we going to get there? And by darn, it's supposed to be here. And once I settled into it's about the journey, enjoying it, keeping the culture the way I wanted to, that there wasn't this destination and, oh man, if we don't get there next year, we're in trouble. And so the journey was more enjoyable, and now we are well positioned. We learned some critical lessons that have provided a far more mature approach to this launch of the high quantities that we're in the middle of now. So.
You know, Wayne Gretzky is famous for, you know, skating to where the puck's going to be, not where it's at.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue you skated to where the puck was going to be before the game even started.
Yes.
But enjoying the journey, I think that's great advice, mm-hmm. because ultimately that's what it's about.
Yeah.
Enjoying the journey, having the patience, and now you're getting your phone's ringing off the hook with venture capitalists. Your space is hot, hot, hot. So you've paid your dues. But now your time has come, and it's exciting to hear all these things that are taking place. Mel, thank you for sharing your story and your company story with us today on The Bottom Line.
Thrilled to be here.
Our guest this morning has been Mel Torre, the president and CEO of Autonomous Solution. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. You can hear our entire interview with Mel on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Bottom Line podcast. You can tweet me, nicely please, at Savvy Wells or at KCPW Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.